Okay, this is only to introduce some ideas for the debate or the further discussion. About 30 years ago, the Catholic theologian Johann Baptist Metz introduced the term political theology into the theological and public debate in Germany. With this term, he wanted to break out of the narrows of middle-class religion. The slogan of middle-class religion is religion is a private affair. Religion is Privatsache in German. And to escape from the confines of a transcendental and personalistic theology of that time. The other purpose was to formulate prophetically Christianity's message in the conditions of modern society. The point was not, I joined him with his political theology, so that our two names are always combined with a movement of political theology in Germany. Our point was not to politicize the churches. The purpose was to find a theology with its face turned towards the world and a way of talking about God in our time. The deepest roots, the deepest motivation for the rise of political theology was the horror over the failure of the churches, the Christians, and the theologians in face of the German crime against humanity, symbolized by the name of Auschwitz. This was our question when we came up with political theology. Why the appalling silence on the part of Christians? Had the middle-class privatization of religion secularized politics to the depths of this abyss? Was it anti-Semitism, unconscious or conscious, that kept Christians silent when the Jews were deported to the death camps? Was it the misappropriated doctrine of the two kingdoms, Christ for the soul and our life for the fatherland and for Hitler? Was it Lutheran submissiveness to the power that be, all authority is given by God? Was it the Roman Catholic option for the anti-communist dictatorships in Italy, Spain, Portugal, Croatia, and Poland, and in 1933 in Germany too, which kept the Pope silent? These were the questions we had when we came, and we said, this should not happen to us again. We want to speak out if it comes to a similar situation. So our publications show that talk about God in our time increasingly became talk about God, I'm speaking of post-war Germany, in face of Auschwitz and after Auschwitz. For Johann Baptist Metz, what emerged was an anamnetic culture of dangerous remembrance. So memory can be a very dangerous thing, because there are certain people or powers who don't want to be remembered. So remember the suffering of your fathers and forefathers under slavery. Remember the suffering of the victims of Vietnam, etc., etc. You know what I mean. Because forgetfulness is always very quick. It's very strange, but there's not a symmetry. The victims always have a long memory. The perpetrators always have a short memory. So for the perpetrators to enter into the truth, they must listen to the stories of the victims, because they have a better memory. At least this we learned with the memory or remembrance of Auschwitz and the dialogue with Jews and the survivors of the death camps in Germany after the war. So the culture of dangerous remembrance is the one side. And for me it was the theology of the cross, the theology of the suffering God, the passion of the passionate God, and the Christian, the necessary Christian criticism of all political and civil religions. For us, Auschwitz means the hermeneutical conditions in which we think about Christian, talk about God in post-war Germany. This was the point. Up to 1933, you could see in Protestant churches in Germany also the national flag. But after 45, there was no national flag in any German church anymore. I was once with theologians, older theologians from the Confessing Church in Copenhagen, and in a big church in Copenhagen, there was a Dannebrog, the national flag, hanging behind the altar. And I said to my friend, how terrible this mixture of nationalism and Christianity. And he said, well, the Danish people are still innocent. We lost our innocence a long time in the two world wars, so we are no longer an innocent nation, and therefore we have this separation. Very nice melody. But it's different for younger nations. In Africa, for example, nation building is a program, and therefore you have to have a figure of identification of different tribes, for example, Kenyatta in Kenya and others, while in older nations you don't need this anymore. You must decide whether you are a young nation or an old nation. From the very beginning on, this new political theology in Germany enjoyed a stimulating give and take with other contextual theologies which were springing up everywhere. In 1969, through Fred Herzog, I came into contact with Jim Cohn's Black Theology, Black Power, which grew out of the Black Power movement. It took its way, if I understand Jim correctly, between Martin Luther King's integration ideal and Malcolm X's will for separation. In Korea, it was the Minjung theology, the theology of the people, the poor people, in Greek, the Ochlos, which were Jesus' family, and in Korea, the oppressed people, the Minjung people. Saw Nam Dong and Ahn Byung-mu were good friends of mine with the theology of the people. Seeing the resistance of humiliated Korean people to military dictatorships at that time. And from both Black theology and Minjung theology, we could learn that if talk about God in our time is to get anywhere, must keep its sights set on the context, the kairos, and the community. So a real good contextual theology must refer to the context, the kairos, the appropriate time, and the community for which you speak. These three cases, or sees context, kairos, community, is a good question to find out whether a theology is a good contextual theology. Normally all theology is contextual in wider forms and or more narrow forms. Only some academic theologians think that they live beyond space and time and without context, but you can easily understand what a theology in the 19th century in Germany or in America was. If you ask what is the context, what is the kairos, and what is the community they speak for. What deeply moved all of us was what Jean Baptiste Metz described as a Latin American landscape of cries, a landscape of cries. This was the authority of the suffering in which the authority of the judging God manifests itself in the world for all human beings. But it was not easy to follow up the theology of the liberation of the oppressed, which is self-evident, by a corresponding theology of the liberation of oppressors. For they are generally blind to what they have done or what they are doing. But however, there can be no good liberation of the oppressed if there's not at the same time a liberation of oppressors. To liberate the oppressed is self-evident, at least for oppressed people. The liberation of oppressors is not self-evident, at least not for blind people. And to make the blind see is another miracle of Jesus, which is not always given into our hands. But if oppression is a sin, there are on the one side the victims of this sin, and on the other side the perpetrators of this sin. So you must liberate both of them. This was another lesson I got on the flight back home from this Mexico City conference in 77. I asked myself, they all talked about liberation of oppressed black people, of oppressed poor people, of oppressed women. What's about the other side? I am now returning to Germany, where white people, rich people, and male people live. Don't we need a liberation of the oppressors of them? So then at the end I came up with a new kind of a doctrine of justification. Normally we say we are all sinners and we are justified by grace. But sin always has the two sides. On the one side, the perpetrators, on the other side, the victims. So is God not justifying the victims first and then also the perpetrators by grace? So there's he gives rights to those who suffer violence according to the Psalms. This is the right creating righteousness of God, and on the other side, through transforming grace, he is liberating the perpetrators. So at least this is one step further. If we are all sinners and justified by the same grace, we don't see the differences anymore. And this is perhaps an error of our tradition. The Roman law system was always perpetrator-oriented and not victim-oriented. And therefore, the punishment of the perpetrator is already enough, but for the victims, it's not enough. Okay. I will not go into the other contextual theologies we then have with the feminist theology and the differentiation and womanist theology and mujerista theology in Latin America. What I learned and what I would like to put into the debate here is the three principles of every contextual theology. What is your context? What is your kairos, the appropriate time to do something? And what is the community you are talking for? And the other problem was, the other correction I have over against my friend Gustavo Gutierrez and liberation theology, they always speak about the poor. But if you really live between the poor, they are only poor in respect to the rich. Otherwise, they are men or women, they have their own culture, their own tradition, and you should not address people on what they do not have, but first of all, on what they are. And therefore, it's sometimes an insult to say, well, you are the poor, you must be liberated, and now we analyze the reasons why you are poor with capitalism and your own laziness, etc. You must address the people not on what they do not have, but on what they are, because there are the potentials to change their life and get out of the situation, which is the problem. Okay, these are the two points. I was short enough, I hope. Okay.
Notes here. Thank you. Questions? Comments? Could I just ask for, if you don't mind, just real quickly, clarification, maybe an elaboration on the doctrine of justification as it relates to the victim. You could just expand on that somewhat. Distinction you were
Well, I have problems at the moment with the translation. Die rechtschaffende Gerechtigkeit Gottes, der Recht schafft den Witwen und Waisen, der denen Recht schafft die Gewalt ein. Who is creating rights for those who suffer violence? Who is creating rights for the widows and the orphans? This is a justice creating righteousness of God. And is related to the victims, while the justification of the sinners is a justification of the wrongdoers, the perpetrators of oppression and of sin and injustice. And this is transforming grace, as we have it in our tradition. But the justification of sinners is only the one side. It's not the justification of the victims. And therefore our tradition was one-sided. It's good if sinners experience the transforming grace of God, but what's with the victims? I think this we learned in the last years after the war, etc.
So in your view, something to progress, restorative, but something to restore.
Yeah.
That part of forgiveness.
Well, in, according to liberation theology, we say God is always on the side of the victims because in Christ he became a victim himself. This is his solidarity with the victims, and he is creating or restoring rights, the rights for those who have deprived of their rights. This is the first act of the justification on the side of the victims. And then follows the justification of the perpetrators, the sinners. But to speak that we are all sinners is not to take care of what really happened.
There's some vindication that's needed
for those who did. Yeah, according to the Old Testament, it's a creative justice of God on the side of victims of violence. And according to the Apostle Paul, we are all sinners and live by the grace of God, which is certainly also true, but it is only the one side. We have two testaments.
But it's not the condition of victimhood or the condition of poverty that elicits our justification, but it's who God is in relation to poverty and being a victim.
Yeah, Charles, could you also say it's where God is and where Christ is? According to Matthew 25, these are the sick and the imprisoned people and etc. And there is Christ already present.
Sure, please. Fight it out.
My question's about memory.
Yeah.
And you talked about the importance of memory, and that the oppressed people are have a longer memory than the oppressors. And this is a question, I guess, to Mark Bornik too. Miroslav Volf talks about that in the process of reconciliation for the oppressed person, there is an unremember that they're given a gift of losing memory. It's hard to use the language correctly, because in heaven there can be no memory of Auschwitz. But for me it seems a very dangerous thing to suggest that part of Christian reconciliation is to receive a gift of forgetting. I don't quite know what to do with that. And I know Mark talks about that in his book. So I was wondering, I'm struggling with the role of memory and sort of healing.
Uh-huh. Perhaps you want Bornik to answer that question. In your book, you have quoted Miroslav's forgetfulness.
There's a story I use in the issue of memory. It is very dangerous to say people will forget horrible things under them. You want that to happen. I think the example that the way that I came to talking about that, as I recall, was the story where the block had been completely rebuilt. A number of new homes had been put up. And I remember the dedication, the celebration. There was like 1,000 people in the street, and it was singing. People were singing and offering testimonies, and people had lived on that block and literally grown up on that block, and now getting the keys to a brand new house. And I think what, without putting words in their mouth, I think that there was such a transformation of their experience that while they didn't forget it, it had been, but they could never forget how horrible it was. And in fact, there was some real tragedies, besides the daily ones, that I think people came to a new experience of their life, that in some ways it was so powerful that some of those things receded, but never entirely gone. So I think that there can be, I think it's dangerous to say we're always, forgetting and all that. That becomes somewhat simplistic. But there can be ways that grace and restoration come into human community and life that can fade some very hard things and put a new perspective on life. That's
can we perhaps call it the healing of memory? So you have torturing memory and you have healed memory, and your memory can be healed if the other side takes part in the memory, if they do not forget.
I would like to tell you a story that happened to me last Tuesday afternoon, where I was with a very powerful man in the United States government. And
who was that?
It wasn't the president. And it was a very off-the-record kind of gathering with a few people that somebody on his staff had said, I want him to hear about the oppressed. And so we had this off-the-record time. And one of the men that was expressing the memory was a man who had been in prison for murder and understood the cross in prison for murder and was giving some of the memory because he knew the memory that you're talking about of Auschwitz. The very powerful man had heard a sermon in the church on that Sunday that talked about justice for the poor. And so he was saying, I don't know what it is that you, and he looked at this other group that were the victims, mean, what is the injustice? His memory is so short because his life has been so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And this other man was able, out of the victory memory, is what I would call it, because this man has known over the past 30 years who the Jesus of the Christ is. Mm. So without a poor me spirit, he was able to paint real pictures for the powerful man, that the powerful man had just never had the conversation. Mm. And the conversation was given to him by the person that was the victim. So that's why I really resonated with what you were talking about, mm-hmm. listening, that the oppressor needs to listen to the memory of the oppressed, to learn from that about then what are those injustices. And this man was dealing with it, and the man that is the prison victim was able to paint such a vivid picture that the conclusion at the time was the next hearing that was going to be held on some of these social justices was going to be in the place that the victim chose, not mm-hmm. the Capitol. Mm-hmm. So I thought that I really resonated. Does that fit what you're talking about?
Oh, yeah.
I just resonated with what you said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Desmond Tutu once said the problem of racism in this country would never be solved until we listen to each other's stories. And that the transformation of memory, I think, happens when we listen to one another's stories. And you wrote about that. When a victim's in the beloved community, when a victim's memory is an oppression and it's transformed to a liberation, and empowerment's changed the nature of relationship and the discovery of having to be in conversation, dialogue, relationship with the victimizer in order to move from paralysis to grit. Mm-hmm.
If the victims and the descendants of victims experience that their memory is suppressed, forget about it, etc. They feel as if they were done injustice or killed the second time. We have this debate at the moment with Armenia and the Armenian genocide in Turkey in 1915. The Armenians don't want reparation, they want to be acknowledged. So that the victims are not killed by forgetfulness or repression again. If Turkey would acknowledge this, that this happened in the Ottoman Empire, etc., the Armenians would be not satisfied, but they would have the feeling to be accepted and acknowledged. And this is a relief. We had this with the survivors and Jews of the concentration and the death camps. If we keep this memory alive as Germans, they would be relieved and accepted and acknowledged in what they had, their forefathers and mothers had to suffer. And this is a first step for healing and reconciliation. And I think this is important.
I would say that the place that's so important is the memory, faith, and grace. Because if you hold on to the feelings, I know I deal with a lot of people, 80% of the women in our church have been raped. Mm-hmm. Many of them ritually raped, many of them just raped, most of them when they were young. And talking with them is talking about telling the story and then praying for the ability to just release the feelings to God. The story doesn't change. Mm-hmm. The story is still true. But not to hold on, to need to hold on to being the victim still, not to hold on to the powerlessness, the fear, the anger, mm-hmm. the hatred, mm-hmm. the self-hatred, all of those feelings. And that, you know, I think that's where grace and the Holy Spirit mm-hmm. come in. Because you can't do that for somebody else. I've never been able to free somebody else, myself, from being captive to the feelings of being a victim. And to be able to just have, encourage them, open them the opportunity to share that with God. And then they can hold on to the facts. And that has to be held on because it colors who they are and why they are and their history and why they're addicts and why they're alcoholics and why they ended up in jail and prison. But able to release unto God the feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can talk with the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as the feelings are controlling, then it's very hard for them to have a conversation with the perpetrator that doesn't end up being just either becoming victim again or wanting to be the perpetrator themselves. And so that, I think, is where this... It's memories bathed in grace.
Right.
That
very good point. Yeah.
I just had a question about theology being local and universal. And my question is just that, you know, like a lot of the stories that people are talking about, you know, happen in a certain time and in a certain place, and they're very local. You know, there's a little kid at your backyard, you're going up maybe to the church community, or wherever the connection or the stories or these places of connection with God happen. So does this theology that turns its face toward the world have to be kind of a local theology?
The local is a universal. So the more concrete you speak, the better people on the other side of the world understand you. If you go into the universal by abstractions, nobody will understand you. So the more concrete we speak out of our situation, the better people in Nicaragua and Korea will understand you. Because it's not so unique what happens in Nashville.
This question arises at the beginning of your statement, when you talked about the way political theology emerged.
Mm-hmm.
Does this kind of thinking still motivate the Christian community in your place, or has this passed away? The question of the church's appalling silence is one that for some of us now, in our current situation, it seems very urgent to consider. And we need somehow to learn, whatever it is you learn, about how what it meant to be silent in the face of this kind of evil. Because if we don't learn it, the suffering you went through and the struggle you went through is not available to us, which it ought to be as part of the Holy Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're in trouble. So anything more you can say about that, maybe that's what you're going to speak about when you do your speaking at St. Paul's, but if there's anything you can say about that now, we're in trouble.
Well, after the war, we felt deeply ashamed about the fact that we had privatized religion and left politics over to the dirty hands. This is a famous saying in German, politics is for dirty hands. So keep your soul clean and your private life. Only this is important, and we left this over to Hitler. There was not much resistance, not the necessary resistance, and there were some reasons, and the main reason was the privatization. Religion is a private affair, or just selfishness. Martin Niemöller made once for the following stories. After 1933, the Nazis first deported the Social Democrats. Well, I was not a Social Democrat, so I didn't care. Then they deported the Jews. I was not a Jew, therefore I didn't care. Then they deported those from the trade unions. I was not a member of the trade union, so I didn't care. And when they deported me, there was nobody who cared for me. So this would then be the end. Yeah? And therefore, better stand up and protest as soon as things are getting worse.
It's not, what's puzzling to me is I can understand how you came to that conclusion after the fact. That is, after the great tragedy, there's no way to avoid it. You had to wrestle with it in some way or other. But I don't know is whether it's going to take us going through the same tragedy before we can say the same thing that you came to say, or how it is we can appropriate without any more. We're already into it, but how we can appropriate it any more in advance. Or something. I'm sure you can't help about that. I mean, it's what we
always
wrestle with.
You don't expect me as a German to tell you what you as Americans should do in your situation today. But I believe there's enough love for freedom in this country to find the right way. Let me stop at that point. Otherwise, I will go too far.
Pursue it a little bit more, but I had the exact same question with George, but I don't want to give him my spot, so I'll try to do it. I think the agonizing question for me, and I think our pastors, as we wrestle with our own congregation, but reflect on the larger church in America, is this whole. I think of it in terms of, is the crisis theological or is the crisis a crisis of will, you know, in other words. And so as you talked about the privatization or maybe a privatized theology, and you talked about the silence and all that, and then that really motivated a desire to develop a political theology and all that. I mean, I feel like there's a growing push for that same sort of political theology that is lost in our country, and yet for me I just feel like there's this huge cynicism, like, you know, we're going to try to bring or reawaken a necessary political theology, but it won't make a bit of difference. So I just wonder how you wrestle with that tension of, you know, I mean, it's one thing to know something, it's one thing to propose something. Another thing for it to actually convert and transform the church. I'm talking about not even just society, but the church in that society.
Well, think about the truth and your conscience, and not about success or failure. Certainly, there are situations in which the protest against the evil powers will make you lonely. Your congregation will not follow you, rich families will leave the congregation, etc., etc. When Bonhoeffer went into the resistance movement, he became very lonely.
But don't we have a political theology? I mean, like, in America, I mean, like, the whole thing that's so frustrating to me, it's almost like there needs to be a new political theology or something that, when you bump up against, when George Bush came, before he invaded Iraq, came to Nashville and met with some of the religious leaders, and he was talking about whatever it's called, faith-based initiatives, but we were talking about the war and saying, please, don't go to war. And he said, I'm at perfect peace. Before the invasion, he was at perfect peace, and his language of theology came out of his faith, and he was completely convicted and turning his face toward the world and blowing it up.
So did Hitler. Yeah. Hitler had incredibly God-intoxicated speeches.
Oh, yes.
You mean it was all the death and resurrection of the German people, was mirroring the death and resurrection of Christ.
Well, Hitler's religion was providence, the Vorsehung, which brought him to the leadership, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it was a kind of religious messianism which filled him. And this is dangerous. This is against Christ, against the crucified Christ, the risen Christ. This is... you must protest this, and if your president is using features of this type of political messianism, always almost manifest destiny, etc., I can go on with this because I was always fascinated with the political religion of the United States of America, especially the empire ideas, etc. There's only separation, and you must oppose this if you are Christians and speak out prophetically. But please don't press me to speak more about America, because you know better what the case is. We in Europe are frightened, I must say, by this new imperial language and these lies with which people, your people, were brought into the war of Iraq. And we remember we had a similar thing at the beginning of World War II. Polish troops attacked a radio station in Gliwice, Silesia, and on German soil. And this was then the beginning of World War II. Now we fire back, was Hitler. But these Polish troops were SS in Polish uniforms. And now you are still looking for the mass destruction, weapons of mass destruction, and cannot find it. They were never there. So it's... I was always critical over against German politics, but this was a point when I agreed with my Chancellor Schröder to say no to this type of war.
I guess what this brings up, and I was thinking about Charles's earlier question about justification, and what I see you doing that's very creative is not simply engaging in a critique of the powers, but or reformulating Christian doctrine in a way that better mirrors the vision of justice that you have, say, in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening with justification is you're operating with an understanding of Jesus as the incarnation of God's justice with regard to the preservation and redemption of Israel, so that God is on the side of the oppressed, and yet God will also bring to restoration those who have fallen mm-hmm. short of God's rule.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus is in the same way the manifestation of God's justice in his fellowship with table fellowship with sinners, mm-hmm. and his standing with the poor, and his solidarity, and his bringing up also perpetrators into the kingdom.
Oh, yeah.
So in a sense, that's the grounding. And what I like about what your example to us is, what we can take away from it, is that the need for political theology has to go all the way down. The way that a lot of Americans like to talk is Americans like to think that no one really understands Christianity. So these megachurches, they're not really Christian. The purpose-driven life isn't really Christian. But in fact, the problem with Christian theology is that it often, the way that we've received it and the way that we talk about it, often generates and perpetuates some of the very injustices that we abhor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I find that a very helpful thing. The other mm-hmm. thing that comes to mind was the issue around memory. I would really encourage you just to see Miroslav Volf as wrong, rather than trying to assimilate it, because it's a very different understanding. And the problem with Volf is operating out of ethnic conflict, and that's the question. Memory operating with ethnic conflict is different than your understanding of memory is from Auschwitz and from horrendous evils.
Yeah.
And so memory, for what you're speaking about, is a moral exercise. Mm-hmm. And keeping in mind, say, Jewish understandings of forgiveness, which no one is allowed to forgive on behalf of the victim. Only the victim can forgive, and the only way we can remember the victim rightly is by remembering the victim's rage and protest, which is why you can be a Jewish atheist, as you were saying in the earlier thing.
Mm-hmm.
So memory is itself has to be kept in terms of a context and a community. It has specific functions. Memory of domestic abuse is a very thorny issue. Memory for perpetrators, all how we operate with memory, it's not memory itself, but the function it has within the community that can speak about where it is. So I mean, the fact that the resurrected Jesus still bore the marks of his crucifixion speaks that there's certain memories that we have to keep in mind always, or else our very fellowship with God is compromised.
But it's transformed. The wounds of Christ can transform.
Right.
And I think most recently, that's what when you talk about the difference between in a technological age where we talk about computer memory, which is just storing everything, as opposed to the human act of memory. But the human act of memory in telling is already transformed. It's already you've done something with the raw materials. So maybe that it's something that Christian memory is about what you do with those raw materials as a Christian. But I thank you. I think we're responsible as well.
I think wounds can be changed into scars.
Yeah.
And the wounds of Christ are then the scars which remembers the crucifixion. And our wounds can be healed and then they become scars so that we would not forget about it, but they are no longer torturing us. And the place where we can tell our stories of suffering, I think, should be the graveyards.
The thing that comes to mind is that Servetus is a biography of the life of St. Martin, where Martin is confronted by a vision of a young man who says, "I'm Christ, Martin, and because of your good works, I've come to be with you first before I'm about to descend to earth." And Martin just looks at the image, and finally he rebukes it.
Uh-huh.
And the image vanishes, and it reveals a foul odor, which they interpreted as being the demonic. And the thing that tipped Martin off was that the figure bore no wounds.
What?
And
that's good.
I think most of us would actually get fooled. My fear.
Well, to come back to the given situation, I think in churches we should remember the victims of the Iraq war. On the one side, 100,000 Iraqis, and on the other side, 1,500 Americans, and should remember them again and again. Mm-hmm. And this would already be enough as a prophetic voice, if you remember that, and because there are people who would like to forget it, to repress it, and go on. We must look to the future now, etc., etc.
Well, can you just say something about pacifism in this political theology and the role it plays in the development of it for you and for our, where we are in 2005?
Well, that's a long, a long story. We came during the peace movement when there were atomic missiles on the one side of Germany and on the other side too, in 80 and 81, we came to the conviction that under the given conditions of world destruction, no war can be justified anymore, because every war can lead to world destruction, and you are not allowed to threaten your opponent with world destruction. This is suicidal and nonsense. So we left the old doctrine of a just war behind. The Roman Catholics still use this doctrine of the just war, and Pope John Paul II's refusal of the Iraq war was on the basis of the doctrine of just war, that this is an unjust war, cannot be justified. Well, we were more on the side that there can be no war justified anymore, because it has become too dangerous with the means of mass destruction. These are two approaches, but pacifism alone is too negative to say no war anymore. God, every war is against God's will. Okay, that's fine, but it must be have a positive side to work for for peace in justice, because without justice there can be no peace. So the work for social and political justice on earth and ecological justice is the positive side of pacifism. And for this we must be ready to sacrifice as much as we had to sacrifice in a war.
We have about 8 or 10 minutes left, and we have two. Can I just say two final questions, Richard and then Melissa?
Mine is brief. Thank you so much once again. Earlier in your talk, you made reference to the high degree to which Christ was spirit-driven.
Yeah.
And the role of the spirit in life of Christ as a way of affecting transformation in the first century.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering to what degree the mythological phenomenon of Zeitgeist becomes a way in which God breaks through human history and uses theological concepts and our will to affect social transformation in our modern day.
I think the word Zeitgeist came up in Hegel, Hegel's philosophy, and is used only negatively. If you are against liberation theology, for example, in Germany, you say, well, this is just to follow up the Zeitgeist. And whoever marries the Zeitgeist will be a widower tomorrow. And nobody has seen the Zeitgeist yet. I think it's not very useful to speak of the Zeitgeist. Everything can be called the Zeitgeist.
Dr. King often referred to, for example, Rosa Parks and these others as being tracked down by the Zeitgeist, and as a result of that, engaged.
I would not say that the Zeitgeist. It was the spirit of God who encouraged Rosa Parks not to follow the command of the driver and to go back, but to defend and stand up for her rights. So stand up for your right. And that's the spirit of God, I believe. To give way to the evil is not God's will and not God's spirit.
Then I think we might have time. Joe, did you have a... Okay.
Or I can make it quick.
No, we're fine.
I just wanted to go back to the conversation you were having about the state of the American church and what a political theology would be. And I think it might have been Rene Girard, I'm not sure because I'm not a theologian, who said that we define Christians as people who identify themselves as persecutors of Christ. And this goes back to how we think of the victim and how we think of the perpetrator and that Christ actually inverts that, because the finger that points this way has to always point this way. And I'm thinking also of the state of the church in its divided form, and Bishop Tutu responding to one of the Catholic bishops who had, I think in Boston, who had been so involved in the sex abuse scandals. And they said, aren't you glad you're an Episcopalian, basically, or an Anglican? And he said, no, the church is one. And the brokenness in the church, I take that on as myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't stand apart from George Bush, because he claims to be a Christian. He is a renegade Christian, and he doesn't have a political theology, but he does claim to be part of the church. And so I think it's interesting, in Gornick's book, he's talking about Nehemiah, and what does Nehemiah do when he hears of the problems of his people? He falls on his knees, and he confesses his sin.
Mm-hmm.
He confesses the sin of his community. And can you just speak about the finger being inverted in Christianity, and how we can... I mean, apply that to this situation, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not quite sure whether I have a good idea and a good answer to it. Desmond Tutu is certainly right. We should feel solidarity with the other churches and their problems, and share their suffering, and not say, well, it's good for us Protestants if they have this problem with homosexual priests, etc. That's not good. So ecumenism or the ecumenical solidarity is first of all a solidarity with the problems of the other churches. And in this way, Desmond Tutu is right saying this, we are one church. And if you remember the motto of the ecumenical movement of John 17:21, the high priestly prayer of Jesus to his Father, that they all may be one as you, Father, and me, etc. Is this prayer not heard by God? If it is heard, we are one. Even if we divide ourselves from each other, we are in the eyes of God one. Otherwise, we would say that this was an unheard prayer. This would be an insult to Christ.
Speaking about Nehemiah and building the wall, and how Nehemiah was able to look past, coming off a statement that you made, that not to look at what they don't have,
mm-hmm.
But look at who they are, and how Nehemiah didn't look at what they didn't have there, but he could see the gifts and talents that were there to rebuild the wall. And what's your opinion on seeing that the church look more at what the possession is, tangible possession they can see, more than the talent of maybe a broken community or individual?
Well, if you address people on what they are, you discover the energies of the people. You give them a new feeling of being accepted, being loved by God in all their richness, and not relate to them, you are poor, you can do nothing, and then you agree with their self-hatred or their depression. And I think this was a weak point of liberation theology, at the beginning at least, to speak always about the poor. While there were some Pentecostal preachers, I'm referring to Gustavo Gutierrez in Lima, Peru, when I visited him, and they went into the barrios in Peru and told the people what they can and what they are, while we were sitting outside and analyzing the situation with the help of Marxist theories, etc. And this was not very helpful for them. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay.